I'm going to ask you to take a Bible and turn to Matthew chapter 5. I'm going to read verse 7 as we continue our studies in the Sermon on the Mount. Matthew chapter 5 and verse 7. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. We've gotten to a word this morning, a quality this morning that everybody identifies with Christianity, with the real essence of Christianity. In Paul's prayers that he mentions several times, he groups three words together: grace, mercy, and peace. And so in regard to religion, mercy is an extremely important subject. You may recall the lines of Shakespeare from The Merchant of Venice. The quality of mercy is not strained. It drops as the gentle rain from heaven. And there's a lot of truth, a lot of wisdom in that line. We'll be talking about some of that. But we are going to talk about mercy this morning. Remembering that in the Sermon on the Mount, we're looking at the distinguishing characteristics of those who are Christ's disciples indeed. These are the qualities of character, the birthmarks by which one who is a member of the kingdom of heaven, one who has been born into the kingdom of heaven, is going to have these characteristics, these marks. And all of these characteristics promote blessedness, or as some versions have it, they promote happiness. All of these characteristics are meant to make our life better. You've probably in life been asked to do things that contributed nothing to your life because you were doing them for someone else. You were doing them to please someone else whose interests were not your own. But in the kingdom of heaven, in these characteristics that Christ is discussing, every one of these is meant to make our life better. Happiness in life is never dependent on possessions or lack of possessions. Happiness in life is always dependent upon virtue. And one of the virtues that a happy person, a blessed person, is going to have is the quality of mercy. So we're going to look at that this morning. I've got three subheads for this study this morning. We're going to begin with a definition of mercy, and then a couple of illustrations of mercy, and talk about the consummation of mercy, some of the takeaways from our study this morning. So let's begin by talking about a definition of mercy. Now, there is a lexical definition, a dictionary definition I might give to mercy that I use sometimes to distinguish the words grace and mercy. I think grace can be defined as giving someone something they don't deserve, they've not earned. Grace involves a gift. When you give someone a gift, it's not something they've earned. If you give them something they've earned, we call that a paycheck. But to give them a gift is to give them something they've not earned. Mercy is not giving something what they have earned. It's nice to get gifts. It's nice to give, to get something for which we've done virtually nothing to get it. And it's also nice not to get what we deserve sometimes. And mercy is the quality of not giving a person something they deserve. Now that's the dictionary definition of mercy. But I think there is a better, more heart-generated definition of mercy. And it would be this: mercy is that aspect of love that when it sees suffering in someone else, cannot walk away from it. A friend of mine sent me a cartoon the other day. It's a lady pushing a stroller. She's got her child in the stroller. It's a sunny day. She's on the sidewalk. She's pushing the stroller with one hand. She has a book she's reading with another hand. And there behind her, she's going past a house that has caught on fire. I mean, the flames are shooting up. And she's pushing the stroller, reading her book, and the caption to the picture said, "This year, I've decided to mind my own business." Mercy is when we cannot mind our own business. Mercy comes into play when we see someone in trouble, someone suffering, and we can't just walk by pushing the stroller and reading the book. We've got to do something about it. I want us to go to a passage in Matthew chapter 9, and we're going to look at verse 36, because I think we have here in one, two verses the model of mercy. And I would ask you to recall this passage whenever you think about mercy and want to study it more. But in Matthew chapter 9, Christ has been teaching, preaching, and healing. And in verse 36 it says this, "When he saw the multitudes, he was moved with compassion for them, because they were weary and scattered like sheep having no shepherd. Then he said to his disciples, 'The harvest truly is plentiful, but the laborers are few. Therefore pray the Lord of the harvest to send out laborers into his harvest.'" I think there are four aspects of mercy that we can identify from the verses I just read. Mercy involves seeing something. When he saw the multitudes, mercy involves feeling something. He was moved with compassion. Mercy involves praying something. Pray therefore the Lord of harvest. And mercy involves doing something. Seeing, feeling, praying, doing. That's what's involved in the mercy that Christ is talking about in the Sermon on the Mount that we're talking about this morning. Now let's go back and look just for a minute at each one of these. Mercy involves seeing something. Mercy is triggered by our awareness of a situation in our proximity or anywhere. We become aware of a situation. We see something. John in 1 John chapter 3 verse 17 says that when we see our brother has need, it starts with seeing. It starts with awareness. Now what was it Christ saw when it says, seeing the multitudes around him? There are two things said that he saw. He saw men in the King James, he saw men who were fainting. My version I read said, he saw men who were weary. But I like that word, fainting. Have you ever fainted? Have you ever been with someone who has fainted? On the last day that Chanute Air Force Base was open, they were having ceremonies on the base, and I took my two boys, Gary and Steve, and we went out to the big hangar for the lowering of the flag. They were shutting down the base, and Steve's standing next to me. He is, oh, I don't know, 10, 11, 12, that age range. And all of a sudden, he just gets a little wobbly on his feet, and he pitches forward, and I caught him and helped him back up, stand on him. He kind of came to. We took him to the doctor the next day. He just got heated or overheated or something like that. There's no problem. Never happened again. Christ saw people fainting. When you faint, you pass out. When you faint, you collapse. Now, it doesn't mean that in the multitudes that Christ was looking at, they were dropping like flies. That's not what this meant. Christ was not looking at men outwardly when he saw them fainting. He was looking at men inwardly, in their soul. He saw men collapsing. He saw men weary because of the burdens that had been put on them. Spiritually, they were exhausted. And that's what human religion does to you. When your religion is not the religion of Jesus Christ, when your faith and hope is in anything other than Jesus Christ, it's going to take more out of you than it ever puts into you, and it's going to wear you down to a nub where you're not strong enough spiritually to stand on your own two feet. That's what human wisdom does. Human wisdom, whether in politics, whether in education, in science, especially in religion, will wear you down to nothing. And that was the kind of people Christ met when He came to this earth. Men who had been taught by those Jewish rabbis, the scribes, under their legalistic system. They had burdens piled on them. Christ said, your teachers will put religious obligations and duties and responsibilities and burdens on you that they wouldn't lift a finger to move. But they expect you to carry them. And Christ, in contrast to the kind of teaching the Jews were getting from their teachers, said, take my yoke upon you, for my burden is easy. For my yoke is easy, and my burden is light. Christ saw men fainting. He saw men scattered. They were all in a big multitude. They were packed shoulder to shoulder. But when Christ looked at that group, He saw men scattered. Have you ever heard the term divide and conquer? That's what Satan likes to do to us. Even if we're sitting here in the same assembly, same auditorium, he likes us to be scattered. We don't know each other. We're not in contact with each other. We're not aware of each other's needs. We don't realize we may be the answer to some brother's prayer sitting in the same pew. Satan likes to divide us, to disconnect us from one another, and then pick us off one by one. One of the reasons church on Sundays is so important, I cannot emphasize this enough. One of the reasons every member of this church needs to be here every Sunday is not only because that's the day of worship designated by the Lord, but this is the one day out of the week when all of us kind of get together. And we need to get together. We derive strength from each other that we don't have in our isolation. We need to spend time together, talk to each other, catch up with each other, encourage each other, pray for each other. Every Christian of the Gibson City Church of Christ needs to be here every Sunday, and that goes for any other congregation you might be a member of. The devil loves it when he can put distance between us. When he can get circumstances and situations to keep us apart, that makes his job easier. Christ saw people fainting, collapsing, exhausted, and disconnected. He saw that. And then he felt something. Our text says he was moved with compassion. Seeing is followed by feeling. He felt something. This brings the emotional part of us into the equation. You know, the word emotion is primarily the word motion. E-motion. What Christ saw put Him in motion. He was moved by what he saw. And the Greek word translated move with compassion is a strange sounding word. Splongnidzo. Move with compassion. Here's how we would translate it today. When Christ saw men fainting and scattered, it was like a gut punch, a punch to the stomach. A strong emotional reaction. Just like getting punched in the stomach and you're doubled over. That's part of mercy. Mercy is seeing. Mercy is feeling something. If you can look at a house starting to burn, there's people in it, and you don't stop to call 911, if you don't stop to run up and see if there's anybody in there, you need to get out. You don't have the quality of mercy that you ought to have, that we all ought to have. And if we're not moved by the needs of people we come in contact with, may God give us the time to mature in our spirit to where we are moved. Christ saw something, He felt something, He said, pray. Pray the Lord of harvest. When you see need and suffering and want in others, always bring God into the picture. Get Him involved. And then do something. A tender heart gives you helping hands. Christ did something. He said, pray that the Lord of harvest would send forth laborers into the harvest. And then keep reading in Matthew chapter 10. You know what He did? He sent His men into the harvest. Pray that God would do it. Now men, you get out and do it. Sometimes we're the answer to our own prayers. Often, we may be the answer to somebody else's prayer. You may be the very person that someone in this congregation or in the community needs with the problem they have. And mercy is making ourselves available to their need. Mercy is making ourselves willing to step into their life. That's what love does. Love connects our lives together. We're two become one. We're I become a part of their life, they become a part of mine. Mercy enables us to step into their life and provide their need. Now that's the definition of mercy. It's the inability to see another suffering without doing something about it. Mercy doesn't allow us to walk away without helping. Now, let me give you a couple of illustrations of mercy from the Old Testament. I've got two. Let's begin by talking about Abraham. In Genesis chapter 13, Abraham and his nephew Lot are starting their business, their shepherding, livestock business there in Canaan. They've left Ur of the Chaldees, their home. They've moved down into a new place, and they're trying to get their husbandry operation going. And they both Abraham and Lot, did really well. They did so well that the herdsmen of Abraham and Lot started arguing with each other about whose flock got what grass. They argued over pasture. And the text in Genesis 13 says this, that while Abraham and Lot's herdsmen are arguing, the Canaanite and the Perizzite lived in the land. You know what that means? That means the neighbors were watching. These two guys moved to town. They moved to the area that they tell us they serve the only true and living God. And they're acting, their folks are acting like that. Well, if that's the kind of church of the true and living God, I don't want to have any part of it. And Abraham understood how that looked, how that quarrel looked to the people in the area. And so he gets Lot together, verse 10. And he says two things. Number one, he says, Lot, we're family. We be brethren. Families are not to be like this, at each other's throat. Quarreling, arguing, angry. Bitter. We're not going to be like this, Lot. We're family. And here's how we're going to solve it. You pick the pasture you want. I'll take what's left over. Abraham realized that relationships are more important than rights. As the patriarch of that family, the head of that family, he could have told Lot, now listen, you young whippersnapper, I had to work my way up to where I am now. You go find your own pasture, and I've got all of this right here. He could have said that. He would have been within his rights, but he didn't. because he understood that relationships are more important than rights. I've got my rights. Well, if you've got any relationships, you've got something more important than your rights. And then in love, Abraham said, Lot, you choose. You go first. You pick. I'll take the leftovers. We read in the book of Romans that in honor, we are to prefer one another over ourselves. That means when there's a disagreement, you say to the other, let's do it your way. Whatever you think's fine. And that's what Abraham did. Now, that's not where the mercy comes in. That's Abraham showing he understood the responsibilities of love. The mercy comes in the next chapter, chapter 14 of Genesis. Abraham said, Lot, you pick. And in verse 13, I think, of chapter 13, Lot looks at all the area, and he looks over towards Sodom, to the east of where they were living. And given the choice, Lot made the worst possible choice he could have made. He moved down to the vicinity of Sodom because back then it looked like the Garden of Eden. I mean, it was green, there was grass, there was water. It was so lush and fertile and verdant, it reminded men of what they had heard about the Garden of Eden. He said, I'll take that spot. And then the next thing the text says is this. But the men of Sodom were sinners and exceedingly wicked before the Lord. He moved his family into Las Vegas, only 1,000 times worse than Las Vegas. And in Genesis 14, there are three kings who attack Sodom and four other cities. And they captured Lot and his family and all of his possessions, his herds, everything. They captured him. They took off. Abraham heard about that. And here's where the mercy came in. Abraham could have said, well, Lot, you made your bed. Now you're going to have to lie in it. I tried to warn you, Lot. You wouldn't listen. What goes around comes around, Lot. You're just getting what you deserve now. That's what he could have said. But he didn't. He got his men. He had 318 men. And went out after Lot, risked life and limb to rescue Lot from the kidnappers, from those wicked kings. And he did. And eventually Lot is going to end up with nothing. He lost it all. Money was important to him. Possessions were important to him. That's why he moved down to around Sodom there. He's going to lose everything he had except two daughters. But in Genesis 14, Abraham's already got 318 employees. That would make him one of the biggest employers in Gibson City. To have a business with 318 employees that he used to rescue Lot. But Abraham showed mercy to Lot in helping him out of what had happened. Second lesson, very quickly, Joseph sold into slavery by his brothers. Years later, he's down there in Egypt. He's risen to governor of Egypt, second in command behind Pharaoh. His brothers show up because of the famine in Canaan. They had to come down to Egypt for food. Joseph recognized them, but they didn't recognize him. And it seems like Joseph is making it rough for him. I mean, he spoke harshly to him. He put some serious demands on them, but he was testing them, trying to find out the kind of men they were. But all along, it was in Joseph's heart to help his hungry family, and he did. He got all of his family down to Egypt, despite what those cutthroat brothers of his had done to him. That was all in the past. And he is going to help them in the present. Now that's mercy. Let me draw this to a close. by mentioning maybe three overriding principles involving mercy under the heading consummation. Because Christ says, "Blessed are they who are merciful, for they shall obtain mercy." That's what we're aiming for in being merciful people, that when the day comes we need mercy, we will receive mercy. Number one, what we are to others, God is going to be to us. In A Christmas Carol, you know, Marley, Scrooge's partner, shows up early in the story and he's got chains on him. Everywhere he walks, those chains clanked. He's a prisoner. He's dead, but he is imprisoned by his own sins. And he tells Scrooge, "I forged every one of these chains. The links in this chain were made by me. The life I lived, the decisions I made, I made the chains that I wear now." As we are to others, God will be to us. One of the first expressions of mercy is in forgiveness. And we just have to turn the page in Matthew from chapter 5 to chapter 6, and we come across this statement, Matthew chapter 6, verse 14. "For if you forgive men their trespasses, your heavenly Father will also forgive you. But if you do not forgive men your trespasses, neither will your Father forgive your trespasses." If there's someone you haven't forgiven that you need to forgive right now, today, you're forging a chain, a link in a chain that you'll meet up with in eternity. As we are to others, God is to us. Secondly, mercy is not just a merciful act. Seeing, feeling, praying, doing. Mercy is not just a merciful act, it's a merciful disposition. I'm going to read Romans chapter 12, verse 8. Listen to this. "He who exhorts in exhortation." If you're good at exhorting, encouraging people, do it. "He who gives, give with liberality. He who leads, do so with diligence. He who shows mercy, with cheerfulness." Now, occasionally we've had people show up here at one of our assemblies asking for help. They're strangers. We've never seen them before. We don't know. We just have their story that they give us. And almost always, the response from this congregation and other congregations is wonderful. It's generous. No hesitation. But every once in a while, and it may not be at the time that the person shows up asking, maybe in a week or a few days, or it'll come back, somebody is griping about it. "Now, we didn't know those people. It was a rip-off, it was a scam, they were just taking advantage of..." You know what? That's often been true. People have shown up here that we've helped, I mean really helped, and they were just using us. Mercy is not just helping someone, it's having the right attitude in helping. When we help someone, regardless of whether we're being ripped off or not, if we can't smile about it, if we can't leave here whistling about it with cheerfulness, God takes note of that. The word translated cheerfulness there, Romans 12:8, is the same word translated mercy seat. It's the Greek word for hilarious. Uproarious laughter. God loves being able to show us mercy. The prophet says he delights in mercy. Has God ever been ripped off? Here's my third point. You know, we worry about people scamming us. You know how many times I have scammed God in my life, promising that if He'll help me with something, forgive me for this sin or that, I'll do better, and I never did any better. I'm the biggest scammer in here this morning. And yet God continues to show me mercy. And he will do to me as I do to others, if I will emulate him and follow his lead and show mercy and let him sort out all the rip-off artists and all of that. God will take care of all that, but let me read you the verse in closing. That's my prayer. And I hope I'll be able to pray with my dying breath. 2 Timothy chapter 1, verse 18. And I'm going to put it in the first person. Lord, grant me that I may find mercy from you in that day. Lord, be merciful to me, a sinner. That's one of the great virtues, one of the great characteristics of this kingdom of heaven, of which we are so blessed to be a part.